revolution.
I've got something important to tell you.
CliffCentral.com.
All right, so business, rather the business masterclass for the next hour. So it's going to be an interesting conversation. It's the skills conversation today is about preventing, managing fraud in your business, and it can happen in small or large businesses. And joining us today is Dr. Brenda Hutting, who's written a book. What's the book called that you wrote?
Curing Corruption. Seven things everybody can do to cure the epidemic of our time.
Okay. And there's a strong leadership element around it. I mean, your leadership journey, research journey, actually took you there as well. We'll
exactly.
get there.
Exactly. It was okay. one of the steps.
All right. Richard Anger's not here today. I've got Alison Nyandu with me and Louis Groenewald as well. And just now we're going to interview as a practical SME owner. In other words, someone who actually deals with this stuff, but he's also an SME owner who started his business on his own, or he started his business following a career in the police, Trevor Henn, Polytech Forensic Investigations. So he'll share with us what he's learned from running his own small business, but also sort of link on to our conversation now. All righty-o, Dr. Brenda Hutting. Now, let me just – there's a global study by KPMG. Global profiles of the fraudster. Technology enables and weak controls fuel the fraud. And the profile of a typical fraudster, interesting, yeah. Let's see what the research shows. Maybe you can tell us if you agree. Between ages of 36 and 55, 69% of fraudsters investigated. So almost 70% are between that age group. Predominantly male or female, what do you think?
Male.
Yeah.
And their name is called Benny Madoff.
Predominantly male, 79%, with the proportion of women on the rise at 17%, up from 13% in 2010. A threat from within, so within your organization, 65% are employed by the company where the fraud happens, holds an executive or director level position, 35%. So they're usually very influential. And employed in the organization for at least 6 years, 38% of them have already been there for 6 years at least, described as autocratic, 18% of them are three times as likely to be regarded as friendly as not. Esteemed, describing themselves as well-respected in their organization. So people are usually surprised they are well-respected. So somehow they guise it or they hide it, I don't know. Likely to have colluded with others, 62% of frauds. Down just slightly from 70% in 2013. And finally, motivated by personal gain, 60%. Greed, 36%. And sense of because I can, 27%. So, Dr. Brenda Hutting with us. You concur with this profile, or have you not studied it from that angle? What would you say about that?
Yes, well, it's a very interesting study. What I say to myself is that we hear about corruption and about the fraud, and there's so many of these programs and in place. But deep down, it's still happening. We're not curbing the corruption epidemic. So something along the way just tells me that everything that we've done so far hasn't had It doesn't have
it's
the
like
results.
Leadership development hasn't succeeded.
Yes, in other words, there's something wrong. So the question I asked myself out of the research of leadership DNA and success DNA, why is it that we can't curb this? And what I came to find is that...
I want you to tell us, how did you get onto... You're into leadership. How is this part of the story? How did you get into this corruption element? Because I know it's from your leadership research.
Yes, what happened is in two chapters of my book, New Leadership DNA, I found that a good leader also invests in mental health, in other words, personal well-being. And when people are in a position of personal well-being and they are satisfied in themselves with who they are, what they have, where they are going, it doesn't mean they have everything they want, but they have already got to a point of maturity of mental health and wellness and what have you, then they are not so susceptible.
Susceptible.
Yes, thanks for that one. to all these kinds of possibilities that come over them. So then I realized we must take the legal issue and all of this and just put it to one side and see corruption and fraud as a mental health issue, because then it can be healed. Because we go out and we make a legal issue of this where people are persecuted and put in prison, and I worked in the prisons for 10 years. I can promise you, to put a person in prison for 10 years and they come out there doesn't guarantee that they won't do it again. So the whole wellness issue is very important, and what a person finds with those age groups that you have mentioned from 35 to 50 is that at that age people have already maybe laid a foundation in terms of financially, family, and also in terms of their jobs. But then they start to realize, I am not living up to what the standards of the world are telling me. And the ego jumps in, and opportunities come along, and they literally take this. So my take on the whole question of corruption that includes fraud is, do something before the beforehand, because we waste so much a lot of time in court cases and things that we have to implement, because prevention is better than cure. And one of these things is to invest in developing the wellness, not just physical wellness, but moral wellness and spiritual wellness and emotional wellness in companies.
And it's fascinating, and I know this is sidetracking a little bit, but for the weirdest reason, Hansi Kronier came into my mind when you mentioned, you know, what did you say, almost spiritual wellness. And when you, he seemed balanced. He seemed like a balanced leader,
you know,
a guy who knew who he was. He was spiritually inclined. He was all of that. And yet he stepped into that same trap.
So there's perception again.
Yes. You know,
it could be perceived.
It could be, yes. Yeah.
You know, I did, it was not only Hansi Kronier, but also a rugby player, what's his name? Joost van der Westhuizen. What I found when I had a look at this, these examples didn't have a clear vision of what they would do after their sports careers.
Yeah.
And
that created some anxiety, I guess, somehow. You think you're totally incomprehensibly attached to that title or that position.
Yeah, but you're already earning millions, you've got endorsements, so how does that work?
You see, because we see the future, what you are saying, is in terms of money. But it's not just in terms of money. You see, every day you need something or someone to wake you up and to actually have a purpose for that day. But when people's sport careers fall away because of age or whatever, that kind of impetus to make me get up in the morning and work for something that is really meaningful isn't there, and people go into anxiety and fear. There are four things that really make my life meaningful: meaning, life itself, death, the ability to do something creative and to work every day, and then the ability to have compassion and love.
Okay, so just bring it back. What drives fraudulent or corrupt behavior then, according to you? You mentioned some of it now, but let's just kind of package it.
Put it together.
Let's put it together. What drives that behavior, whether you're Hansi Kronier, or whether you're a person in a small business where you see cash flowing and you see an opportunity, a gap, or whether you're an executive in a business, which we see a large percentage of them are, what makes you do it?
I'm going to use one word. It's going to make it easier. The level of your self-awareness. If you are aware that you are coming from, and you've been made aware, that you are coming from a part of yourself that is bored. Boredom is one of the biggest problems we have. That you are coming from a part of yourself that's ego-driven, a part of yourself that's fear-driven. If you understand, this is where I'm coming from, you can make different choices, actually by mastering that part of yourself and moving to a higher level and setting a fundamental baseline on a higher level. The other thing that I found is that we are talking about coaching, but we are having people coaching maybe sport or business. But there are very few people who get down to the point where we teach people to coach themselves in those positions.
Mm.
At that moment that they have to make the decision that they say, yes, I will take this money. Mm. And then I know what the consequences will be.
It's interesting. We all have our symbolic moral compass. I remember chatting to Sizwe Nkosana, and he said he often thinks, what would my mother think of this decision that I'm going to make now? It was almost like his moral benchmark.
10 for his mom.
Yeah. So a lot of leaders have that. Their mothers have played a huge impact. Others would maybe use different moral compasses, I guess. But if from where you're coming now then, Brenda, you would say to prevent, yes, we'll talk systems and things now, you know, a toll-free number or anonymous.
Yes.
You know, there are systems and structures we can put in place. And maybe we'll get more practical and we chat to Trevor in the next half hour. But so to prevent it in a business, from the inner self point of view, what must I do as a business owner? I'm running Liberty Life. I'm running a small business. What is the...
Adrian, you know what I found when doing the research on the corruption book? That the biggest problem of corruption is ignorance.
And on whose side?
Yes, and people just don't know how to deal. They don't have the skills and the tools. And business owners should actually invest in having their people become sensitive to where they are coming from and the kind of choices they make. Because when people come from ignorance, fear, from their egos, and they are placed in a position where they have to make a choice of right or wrong and good or bad, and they can actually in the end better themselves by doing something illegal or corruption or what have you.
Brenda, are you saying the ignorance you mentioned now is really ignorance of who they really are, or the inner self?
Yes, personally, my opinion, if people know who they really are, they know that if they overstep the line, it's going to be detrimental, not only to them personally, financially, but also their family, but also their health. I think Joost van der Westhuizen is a wonderful example, that he denied all the allegations made against him up to a point he couldn't deny it anymore. And then when it became public, physically, a human being reacts so strongly to this, that I do believe that it also contributed to him becoming very ill.
I've forgotten what the issue was, actually, now that you mention it.
Yeah.
The Hansi thing, I don't remember the worst issue.
It's a moral discrepancy. Yeah.
It's a moral issue, yeah.
And if people can understand that there are different ways, business owners, personally I feel, need to put things in place that could be a place where people could go to and talk to. Maybe this is a place where people can come to and say, listen, I don't have the money, and here is the pay that's just come in from the shop, and if I'm going to take this money, I have an alternative choice to actually speak to somebody before I actually do this. I just want to give you a bit of background. Sometimes it just starts with something small.
Yeah.
You just take maybe a rubber band out of a drawer and you take it home for your daughter to make her ponytail or something like that. And then you get desensitized in terms of your conscience. And the conscience is like something that gets moved around, and then the next time it's something bigger, until some very big choice comes along and you've desensitized yourself along the way, and when the big one comes, you take it because nobody else has found you out in the previous choices that you made, and then that's a dilemma. I would just like to add, not only for the person involved, but for the families involved and for the business involved. So my opinion is prevention is better than cure.
Okay.
I think the question is firewalling people against
corruption. All right, so what systems can we put in place to try and help people prevent those difficult decisions that they come across? Because that can also help you. So maybe I would now have actually pressed the wrong button, yeah? But some system stops me from doing it, and I go afterwards, I'm so grateful. You know, I'm so grateful that this system stopped me, because I was actually weak there. I would have done it. There must be systems in place. We can't just work on the inner self. That's the big picture.
Yeah.
That's the important one. Alice?
I think, though, we need to be very careful to not be too overly simplistic about, you know, what we are talking about. I think ultimately this speaks to the pathological side of human nature.
Mm.
You know, there's the, and it's still, I think it's part of the ego, you know, I'm not a psychologist, but there's the bad side of who we are, which would always manifest itself by us making these choices, you know, to take the rubber band, you know, steal the 10 rand, and that sort of thing. But the choice, it also works in an inverse way, because for us to be duped by someone like Bernie Madoff, I mentioned Bernie Madoff earlier.
Remind us again what he
Bernie Madoff was. This guy out of New York, he stole $20 billion from investors. He duped them into a scheme that no one took time to see how is it, you know, that, you know, you can have such a return over such a short period of time. Why? Because the pathological side of ourselves loves a big lie, especially if you don't have to do too much work to ascertain why something sounds so good, you know. And if it sounds good, we all know it probably isn't good. So I just think that there's something out of this conversation that is emerging that needs to focus at accepting the fact that this is what we'll always have.
Fighting the demons inside.
You'll always have bad folks doing bad things. Hence, I'm reluctant to believe that you can really put up systems to prevent. At least you can mitigate, you know, the risks associated with people being bad.
Can I just pick up on that? Thanks. If we could have a scale of a conscience, in other words, that inner voice that tells you don't go there and don't do that, and we'll say at a zero there is no conscience at all, and then we are having to do with psychopaths, and then we say this person's got an overdeveloped kind of conscience. But in the middle, 50-50, most people, it moves up and down, up and down, up and down, meaning that some people, around about 50%, you've got a 50-50% if you even listen to your conscience. And when you listen to your conscience, that little voice that says to you, do it. But exactly what you said. On the other side, we have what we call a shadow self or the dark part of self. That's also talking along. So you need to understand what part are you going to listen to. And I was in a consulting and a workshop, and a young man stood up and he said, you know, I've got two dogs. I've got a white dog who is my real best friend. But then I've got this very dark, angry dog, and that will literally rip you apart. And I realized basically we have those two forces in us also battling with each other, and everybody will need to make the decision which part of yourself are you feeding, because the one that you feed is going to grow. And this is the same way your conscience.
I think Brenda is talking, taking us to another dimension, which obviously there's a spiritual aspect to this, but in existence, we know the fact that there's light and darkness.
Mm.
And these are the two forces that also constitute who we are at the deeper level. So the question is, how does one become able to quieten down the demons, so to speak? Because the demon is always there. That's why people would say, he never looked like he could do something like that. You know? And we see more and more of this if you look at how, you know, the terrorist incidents around the world are emerging. You find that there's these gunmen, there's these bombers and this sort of things. Yet they look like the ordinary guy down the street.
In other words, what you're saying, we can't see this at the surface. What I really appreciate of what you are saying here is that we need to make people self-aware, that they have to accept responsibility in that moment. But we don't get taught this kind of self-awareness in terms of being able to master the self, and then we are sort of victim to our own inner demons and our own shadow or dark side or whatever part you would like to call it. And the time has come, and the reason the time has come is because time is speeding up. We can't phone a coach or the pastor or the wife or what have you. We have to make it instantly within ourselves, and those are the skills and tools we have to give to our people.
Do you actually trust your inner voice, your who you really are? Now, I think you are drawing us to a specific level of conversation because of your background and expertise. If you were a systems person, then we'd be talking about systems you can put in place. And we'll talk about that towards the last few minutes, Louis.
And just quickly, on the system side, we may not be able to really address the extreme people, that the bad people. We know that as well. But there's the middle part that we can swing all the time. But I think what Brenda's really saying is we're not going to that extra trouble. Can I just mention our homes and companies? We tell people what is wrong. We tell them, don't do that. But we very rarely treat with passion why.
And what's right.
And the advantages of a moral compass and how that's what you... So therefore, François Pinault... And the use of perhaps two examples.
No, Auntie Cronier, not François Pinault.
No, I speak of François Pinault and use.
Yes.
Use perhaps wasn't prepared for that future. He's just a tremendous rugby star. François Pinault was that, but he was well prepared, and I think he's probably living a whole new vision because of it. So I'm just saying, we tell people what is wrong, but we don't tell them why. We don't tell them what the advantages are of a moral compass, how it affects your happiness and your unhappiness with people around us.
Yeah, and by the way, the next half hour, I just want to say quickly before you speak, Alice, we will speak, I think, also about a few practical things you need to consider in terms of the prevention element with Trevor. I mean, he's in the studio, that's what he does, forensic investigations. So I think we'll get to practical issues as well.
Yeah, I just want to throw this thing that it's fascinating that we should have these sort of conversations, because the world is essentially gravitating towards, you know, moving more, you know, to a systems sort of based approach, you know, artificial intelligence, that sort of thing, and the cognitive side of how people live or work or make decisions. So it's quite important that, you know, we look at the mind aspect of whatever traits, you know, we're trying to do away with, whether it's, you know, corrupt people or people, you know, just, you know, not living to their true values.
That I agree with fully.
Okay. Yeah, interesting. Yeah, the results of this KPMG survey show that technology was found to be a significant enabler for the fraudsters investigated, 24%. So technology played a big role. Cyber fraud, an important form of technology-based fraud, is emerging as a growing threat, and many companies are aware of the issue but seem to be doing little about it. So what should companies be considering to fight this onslaught? Also, a key finding in the survey is that weak internal controls remain a major contributing factor for fraud, up from 54% in 2013 to 61% in 2015. Even if controls are strong, fraudsters evade them or override them. So how does one ensure that your internal controls are sufficient, particularly in a small business? Not easy. Anyone want to try and answer that?
You just keep your business small.
You keep it small. Well, I know from small businesses that were doing really well and later found out their PA was stealing $1 million over a few years. You know, because as a small business owner, you may not be detailed oriented. You're just out there enjoying what you're doing.
Too much hard work.
As a leader, I found I was underestimating the value of good auditing procedures as well. I kind of assumed that people, and then I found out that people hurt terribly because I underestimated the need for plain auditing, not just financial auditing, all kind of auditing, to pick up the trends up around us. And I think I've learned a lot there, because you let people down badly if you allow them to operate without an auditing environment, especially from the financial point of view. And we speak often the business side of that. You know, you must have good auditing procedures to pick up these things. And that applies on the moral side as well.
And this instinct we spoke of earlier, you get an instinct. Something is not right. This person is evading me. This person is avoiding me. Yeah. Something is not right. You know, as a leader, we come back to our earlier discussion, you know, that feeling that tells you something about someone or something is not right. And I think at times we're scared to dig deeper because it may just result in a very important employee who's actually taking you for a ride. And I had that recently. Someone stealing a lot of money from us over a year period. We had to confront the individual. So it happens, you know, from good people you like. I like Alice. I don't want to find out that he's messing up. So I'm not going to dig deeper, even though my instinct tells me, why does he avoid me in these kind of conversations? And you don't follow that instinct.
Yeah, but that, and at the same point, I'm thinking, you're in an organization, you know, someone smokes, they have to take a smoking break. What do you then do? I mean, do you then say they must sign every time they're going out to smoke? Or you kind of think, hey, at the end of the day, people are kind of grown up. You know, you've got to trust people. Why I'm saying this, because I think it's important to also look at the unintended consequences of controls in terms of what that does to the people's psyche. Yes, the trust level. And the trust level. Aspect of an organization.
I add something to that. Not only the trust, but one of the things I have been asking the question about is we are talking about the business environment, and that actually includes a work ethic. Now, when we get to fraud, we must know people have actually sort of left the whole question of working for whatever you want and achieving a certain goal, and they are taking the soft options now to take a quick fix. And in a life where everything is speeding up and everything has to be quick fixes, and I actually asked the question, what kind of example is this setting for our children where a work ethic is concerned and that I really feel proud about my work and what I achieve?
Okay, and that's the challenge we have. We live in a world of instancy. We live in a world of screen ages where youngsters get everything now, press of a button. They want their flat screen and their two cars and their house now. I think reality humbles them, but then maybe we think, I can do things now. Because we can in society. But so we have a lot of things to watch.
We also live in a world where there's unaccountable leadership. I mean, we've touched on this before. I mean, if politician so-and-so is getting away with it, about me? I'm a small guy. Surely I could get away with it too. Because we're not talking millions here. It's just, a couple of thousand rands, So who's setting the example and showing that this is how we ought to... these are the values we ought to ascribe to as a society.
Okay, opening up a whole new conversation, but wow, you're so right. The bigger socio-political environment impacting the internal attitudes and approaches that our people have in corporate. So the best I can do as a business is to work on the internal culture where these things may or may not happen. But then you have the external factors that you can't do much about, actually, which is very challenging. Yeah. Just finally, for big businesses, the KPMG survey reveals that technology is likely not being used enough to prevent and detect fraud. Companies can do more. So the key anti-fraud technology is data analytics, they say. Not that I know what it is, but it's a tool that can sift through millions of transactions looking for suspicious items. But only 3% of companies use proactive anti-fraud data analytics.
Audit procedures, yeah.
So it's that sort of thing. So there are answers, and hopefully we'll touch on it again in the future. Well, that's the conversation on, I don't know, preventing fraud more than
thinking about
fighting
fraud.
It. but I guess toll-free, what do you call it?
Whistleblowers.
Whistleblower sort of lines. All those things are quite logical that you can put in place as a business. And good auditing procedures. There are real technical issues. All right, folks, next up, we will actually talk to someone who deals with these issues from Polytech Forensic Investigations. And it's going to be fascinating, not only a SME owner, but in the field of helping businesses prepare themselves a little bit better for corrupt practices internally. So stay with us. Next up, our SME showcase. Brenda, thank you. But are you staying with us a little bit longer as we chat with Trevor?
Yes, okay. I've been invited.
Okay, good to have you all. Let's take a quick break. We'll be back.
Grant, I need to make a critical business decision. We've been expanding rapidly, and my gut feel tells me that we should be investing for growth. But I need to put some financial science behind that gut feel of mine.
Don't you have a financial manager or director that can help you with that?
But isn't that rather expensive?
It doesn't have to be. Why don't you contact the finance team? They're a consultancy that can provide you with a part-time financial manager or director at a fraction of the cost of a full-time resource.
Go to thefinanceteam.co.za.
Keeping it real on cliffcentral.com.